So I printed the first six pages of what I've got of. I've got already about 10 pages of material, and I printed the first six. That's. I assume we're not even going to finish those tonight. Yeah, we started recording. We're probably not even going to finish those tonight. So there's a lot of material over here. I'll just give you an idea of the of what my vision for this session is going to be. That we would talk about, start with the halachic issues that come up with regards to the new technology surrounding synthetic meat. It's not really synthetic, of lab-grown meat. There's also synthetic, which is something else, which also enters into the conversation probably when we shift to talking about more hashkafic issues like vegetarianism and environmentalism and all that kind of stuff. We'll bring it up here at the beginning so that we...
What's the difference between synthetic and lab-grown? Unless you're talking about clones or something like that.
It's close to clones. We'll see. You'll see. Well, actually, that's the first thing. You know, let's describe what lab-grown meat is, and we'll differentiate it from what I consider to be synthetic meat. So lab-grown meat, this is from an article in Big Think. You could, you know, look it up on the internet. You could find anything about it. But just here's a description of the process. At least as it was last year in 2018, which is now. It's not really cloning. You'll see. Lab-grown meat...
Cells from a living cow.
Okay. Lab-grown meat starts by taking a small sample of cells from a living cow. So it's not actually an artificial synthetic product. It all starts with stem cells from the animal in question. Stem cells differentiate into a variety of cells throughout the body. That's normally what happens. Most lab-grown meat production uses myosatellite stem cells, which become the various tissues in muscles, because that's what interests us, muscles. That's what... you know, good meat is made out of. Then the stem cells are placed in a medium containing a protein. This protein is unidentified in this article that persuades them to turn into muscle tissue rather than anything else, along with the nutrients they need to grow. A cow does the same process, only it feeds the feedstock and its body turns that into the appropriate nutrients. The sample is placed in a bioreactor similar to those used to make yogurt or beer. A scaffold made out of an edible material is also included to encourage the meat to grow in the right shape. You let the whole batch cook for a while, and pretty soon you've got ground beef. This is kind of a colloquial article about it. You can see because there's no scientific really information about it. You make sure that it grows in the kind of the, you know, you don't want like it to be all
sludge.
Messed up, you know.
It's a mold of some kind.
Yeah, it's not supposed to look like a hamburger. It's supposed to look like a steak. So you want it to make sure that
it looks
good.
I don't think that's what
cow.
It means.
What?
I think the frame is something that it grows around.
The scaffold is so that it has the
texture.
Ah, okay.
It's not so you get a steak mold or a mincemeat mold. It's that you have the stuff grows around so that you don't have a texture that is slimy or whatever else. It's
that should look like a steak. That's it.
But it's about the framework that they're putting in is stuff for it to grow around.
Yeah.
And so if you put in strings, it'll come out as mincemeat as opposed to just sludge.
Right. But what they're trying to do, according to in this article...
It's not going
to
come out as mincemeat because it's going to grow like a cow grows. It's going to grow muscles.
It's going to grow as muscles. It's not going to grow...
It's not gonna, mincemeat is, you know, it's been through the mincer.
Yeah.
It's not going to look like that. It's going to look like a piece of meat.
This isn't talking about growing a new cow. It's
No, we're only growing the muscles. That's what we're trying to do. That's what they're doing. So that's as of 2018 and from before. Really, the first time this was done was in the next article in 2013. So this was when it became famous. In 2013, Mark Post, a Dutch scientist and the co-founder of Mosa Meats, which is one of the major producers of this kind of meat, became the first person in the world to make a cell-cultured beef burger. Process used was really expensive, taking three lab technicians about 3 months to nurture the 20,000 fibers of the burger. According to AG Funder News, that pound of lab-made beef would have cost $1.2 million per pound to sell. In the years following, the number was plummeted. At the time when he ate it, I think it was advertised in America as being a $325,000 burger. In March 2017... In 2017, Memphis Meats told the Wall Street Journal that it had gotten the price of a pound of cell-cultured chicken down to $9,000 per pound. A year later, its CEO announced the price had dropped to below $1,000 per pound. And in early 2019, the Israeli-based company Aleph Farms, told reporters they'd gotten a beef patty down to around $100 per pound. Okay, so that is a beef patty, right? That is more like minced meat. That's going to look like a hamburger. That's $100 per pound, which is still quite a lot. And we should keep in mind that the taste over here is not necessarily worked out yet. In 2013. Yeah, it will all get there. But in 2013, supposedly the people who tasted it said it tasted a little bit dry. It didn't taste, you know, so perfect. But, you know, that's just a matter of tweaking. And so presumably it will get there, yes. Now, I want to differentiate this just a little bit from what's actually becoming quite popular in the United States called the Beyond Burger, Beyond Meat, which apparently the stock has like jumped and then went down and jumped again. The Impossible Burger is their competition.
Yep.
There's the Beyond and there's the and the Impossible Burger, which are vegetable or plant-based hamburgers. So those aren't actual meat. Those are plant-based and they just make them taste, but apparently very convincing.
You can't tell the difference.
Veggie burgers, they are sold. I think there's an Impossible Burger being sold in Burger King.
Yes.
What?
Carl's Jr.
And Carl's Jr. Is that Canadian? Is that Canadian? Was Carl's Jr. American. Oh, yeah? I don't know Carl's Jr.
No, but he's a vegetarian burger.
Is an Impossible Burger being sold in Burger King?
Is a vegetarian burger being sold in McDonald's and Burger King?
Right. No, so vegetarian burgers are not new. But the idea that they're going to make something that is so convincing is new. So now, why is this interesting? So first of all, what are the motivations for it? And then we'll talk about what the issues are from a kashrus perspective. So what are the motivations? The motivations are regular motivations. Number one, pollution. Animals are, you know, they seem natural.
Cows.
But cows produce, are the major producer of methane, which is one of the most harmful gases in our environment. And if you can get rid of the cows, or at least so many of them, then that can go a long way towards creating a better environment. Ethical treatment of animals. Having a lot of cows means having to treat the cows. And we don't always necessarily treat them so well. Cows, chickens, everything. Venison, right? We don't treat these things so nicely. If you've ever read, what's his name? Yuval Noah Harari's book, Sapiens. He has a whole section in there about how we've basically, you know, we've made extinct all the animals that we can't eat or that we're not interested in eating and hunting. And we've, you know, natural selection shouldn't have selected chickens to be one of the most populous animals on the planet. You know, that shouldn't have happened, but it did because we want chickens.
We breed them.
We want chickens, we want cows, we want sheep. These are all animals that we want, but you know what? We don't treat them so nicely because there's so many of them and all we care about is eating them. So we just fatten them up. So that's, you know, that's putting aside the shechita itself, which I'm not going to call inhumane, but at least the treatment of the animals, you know, is a casualty of the fact that we like to eat so much beef. Cost. Right now it's expensive, but there's no doubt that once we can perfect the process, the cost of building one of these burgers is going to, you know, be far less than the cost it takes to manage and support a cow, for example. What? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you have to create it, right? The wholesale, which means you need the labs, you need everything. But obviously, it's gonna greatly reduce it. And finally, health potential. What's the health potential? The health potential is that, you know, if they can engineer the burger, then they can engineer exactly the burger that you want, which means that they might be able to make it in a healthier way with healthier ingredients, and they can do whatever they want once they're dealing with the meat on a genetic. Yeah, that's fat. Unless you want more fat, maybe. Maybe fat's good for you. Who knows? Everybody argues about these things. They predict that within 5 years, they think that that there will be it'll be adopted. Either probably the plant-based one will be more adopted at first, and then I was reading an article. They can't know these things, but they say by 2040, lab-based meat will be dominant. Nobody knows these things. You can't trust them. They said there's literally a band called. They promised us jetpacks, right? There's literally a band called, I don't think it's actually they promised, but something like where, you know, we were promised jetpacks or something, and we have no jetpacks, but we have Facebook. So nobody knows how the future will be.
It's like there was a film,
I found it
in
1990.
Oh, man. Got a bad one. Where it said, I got these flying cars.
Yeah.
And, you know, in 2020.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so nobody really knows these things. So now let's get down to the meat and potatoes. So I have here a list of issues that ignore the motivations. All right, I do want to get to the motivations, and what I'm actually, you know, particularly interested in. We didn't actually go through the list of issues. We'll go through the list of issues first. But what I'm interested in is do we care about these motivations from a halachic perspective? So first of all, rundown of the issues before we jump in. Where did the stem cells come from?
I just thought there's also, sorry, and it's wrote as well, the sustainability. I'm just thinking how a few years ago they were saying because of the rising demand for meat in China, there's not going to be enough meat or whatever else in a few years' time. And already here we are. That's probably one of the stimulants for this development of this market. Is the here we are already 5 years later or whatever else, and they're talking about the end of.
From what I understand, Japan is also one of the leading researchers in this. Well, in China, they can eat any, they eat all kinds of meat, so they eat everything, so they don't have a problem.
Just a question, the motivators shouldn't have any impact on halachic ramifications of it.
So I wonder, why do you assume that?
Where do we find motivations having a direct impact on halachic?
That's a good question, one that I'd like to investigate. I would not be surprised if it has at least some impact on it. I wouldn't be surprised about that. Social factors can impact the halacha. When, for example, when you have two positions in front of you, right, and they're both legitimate positions, and one position brings you to a social good, I wouldn't be surprised when a rabbi would choose that, and with, you know, with no shame, and even explicitly so.
You have a halachic basis for the other.
I'm not saying that happens often. I'm saying I wouldn't be surprised that it should happen sometimes, and sometimes it may even be explicit. Sometimes not, sometimes yes. You know, I can think of examples. One famous example that comes up, which we actually talked about on Shavuos, is the phenomenon that Ashkenazim are traditionally more makel on the halacha of on the mitzvah d'oraita of chadash and yashan. Right? We are forbidden from eating grain that was harvested before Tet Zayin Nisan until Tet Zayin Nisan passes. Okay, this is something that Sfaradim keep the world over. And Ashkenazim outside of Israel basically ignore and don't even know about it. For the most part, every once in a while in Brooklyn you'll pass a shop that says Yashan, right? But for the most part,
the shop in Brooklyn says Yashan.
Not every, not even close. Yeah. No, definitely not every. And the bread that you buy in the store, right, is not. So, you know, how did that come about? So there are lots of reasons. And when you look in the Ashkenazi poskim, going back to the Rishonim, late Rishonim, you'll find those reasons. But you get to this kind of inescapable feeling that it has something to do with where they lived. And when you look at where they lived, the fact was that the agricultural cycle in those places, slash the weather in those places, made it extremely difficult for them to store that grain until it would be viable. And so they were willing to rely on certain, they did rely on certain leniencies, which some have attributed to the fact that they needed to. And that, you know, that's the way it is. A more macabre example, the Sfaradi Rishonim were very against martyrdom when it wasn't warranted, and especially suicide. They were appalled by the idea. You can find this on the Beit Yosef. Appalled by the idea that somebody would take their own life when they were being threatened to, let's say, convert to Christianity, right? By the Ashkenazim, there's a tshuva by Rav Meir Rotenberg, where he was asked this question. There's a whole, you know, this is more of a 3 weeks topic, where this person committed to, he killed his family actually. He killed his own family because he thought that the Crusaders were going to come in and convert them, and then he survived because they didn't come. And he wrote to Mary Rottenberg, you know, what do I do for tshuva? He said, I understand where you're coming from. I understood what happened, and he kind of commiserated with him, and he told him what he had to do for tshuva. And if you look in the Beit Yosef and you look at the Sfaradim, they're appalled by the whole idea. How could it be that anybody would even think to do this? And it was because the Muslims were living in a relatively more tolerant Muslim world versus the Ashkenazim, who lived in a much more aggressive and violent Christian world. So sometimes you have these things. You know, that's a far cry from this, but I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of the day you had two poskim and they said, you know what, if this is really going to help make the world a better place, then maybe we should do it. And I wouldn't be surprised if you had the opposite also. You know, if they're pushing it on us as part of a liberal agenda, then we're going to push even harder. I wouldn't be surprised about that either. Number one issue that we're going to deal with is, where do the stells come from and does it matter? Do they come from a kosher animal? Do they come from a non-kosher animal? Do they come from a kosher animal that's been shechted, or is it still alive? Does it matter what part of the body that it comes from?
From a living cow.
Yeah, say from a living cow. Okay, so that's going to be one of the major. Is it parev or is it fleishik? What's in the culture? What is in, you know, we talked about these proteins, right? These things that help grow. Let's say the animal came from a kosher shechted animal, right? Let's say the stem cells came from a kosher shechted animal, but it's being cultured in, let's say, something that's not kosher, for example, blood. What if it's being cultured in blood? Okay? Or vice versa. What happens if you have a piece of non-kosher meat, but it's being cultured in a kosher culture?
Petri dish.
It helps, it provides the nutrients and helps grow the stem cells. Stem cells don't grow by themselves. Yes, it becomes part of the meat. Just like it's the equivalent of what the cow eats. It only, you know, you can, maybe there's a difference between those two. Another one, Marisayan. Let's say we solved all the problems. It was completely kosher technically. But what does it mean? So let's say we say it's parev, right? What does it mean? You want to put a slice of cheese on there. So let's say in the short term.
Define Marisayan, like enough people know that it exists.
Enough people know that it exists, but you're sitting in Burger, well, not Burger King, but let's say Burger King in Israel. You're sitting in Burger King in Israel, and you're eating a cheeseburger. And you don't know. I mean, let's say in the interim, where there's both meat, real meat, and this other kind of meat.
Yeah, but then there'll be a parf milchik.
Good, so what do we have to do to make, is it okay to, by itself, what do we have to do to make it okay? Or is it never going to be okay? Is it going to be okay later? Is it not going to be okay now? Dad, did you live during a time where they were there before non-dairy creamer?
I can tell you a story about non-dairy creamer. When I was working in a hotel,
yeah,
as a waiter, and during a wedding, the owner's friend was in the lobby, and the owner says to me, Joey, that's what they called me, give my friend a cup of coffee. I said, how would you like it? Have like it light with no sugar. Okay. I got some coffee and put some creamer in it, because it was a fleshing meal, of course, and I brought it out. The mashgiach grabbed a hold of me and spun me around and pushed me back into the kitchen. And he says, you bring out the black coffee with a container of creamer, because otherwise...
It was in a container? Like
it was
a carton?
A container labeled,
yeah,
Parva creamer.
Right.
Now today, it's...
What year was that?
What year was that? This was around...
70?
1970, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now today, it's common.
Of course not.
Nobody thinks,
right,
that the family's...
So the question is, is that your fault? Is that because there were waiters like you who just started doing it without? And then eventually...
And he starts explaining me the halacha.
Of course.
He quoted the Yoredei.
Yeah, almond milk. It's in the Shulchan Aruch. The Rama says you put...
Almond shells
in, when they have almond milk on the plate with the meat, so you have to put the almonds there as well. Right? That's like, yeah, the thing. So the non-dairy creamer. So, but when did a non-dairy creamer stop having to be put out? How did that happen? Because nobody puts that anymore. Now people just assume, okay, you put soy milk in whatever. When did that happen? So, and how long does that take, and what's the process for that? And then finally, should environmental concerns affect halacha? And is vegetarianism the future? Right? Or some form of vegetarianism? Is, you know, let's say we said this is all mutar, so should it be like obligatory? You know, should we be encouraging this? All right, so let's start. Yeah, I apologize. You can look in your phone, by the way. I sent out the file, so if you want to look there, then you can do that. Okay, so we'll start with the fun section. All right, this is going to be the most fun. The status of non-natural meats. So you'd be, you know, if I were to ask you, you know, are we going to be able to find old sources that discuss this issue? You'd probably guess no, but I've brought quite a few. And we'll start with the Chumash itself. Ve'el ha-bakar ratz Avraham ve'ikach ben bakar rach v'tov v'yiten el hanar v'yimeher la'asot oto. This is, of course, when the three Arab angels come to visit Avraham, and he is ready to feed them, because he doesn't seem to know that they're angels, it would seem, and he gets for them meat, right? It says, ben bakar rach v'tov, nice, sounds like veal, right? And v'yikach chema v'chalav. Ooh, ben Abakar. Whoa, Avraham, what are you doing? Asher asav, ayten lifneim, v'o omer aleim tachat ayetz v'yochel. He serves the milk and meat together. He couldn't have served them anything else. He had to serve the milk and meat.
It's the best thing.
He had to serve the milk and meat. So what do we do about this? So on the one hand, we can do nothing. You know, he's serving it to somebody else. He serves them separately, maybe even on separate plates. He tells them, do you want flesh? We don't have to do anything with it. But of course we are going to. So the Malbim over here, which is quoted l'halacha, Okay, this Malbim is quoted by the Cheshek Shlomo, or Shlomo Vilna, in Yoredeya. He quotes this Malbim, who says, Vela Bakarat Batsmo, he points out that Avram runs after it himself. The standard way to read this is, Machikata Veikach Musav Al Anar. When it says Veikach Ben Makar, it's talking about how the Nar goes to get the meat. Shanar Lakach Chema V'Chalav. But Natan Lifneim, the Nar goes and he gets the butter and the milk and he puts it in front of them tchila v'acharsh and it's la basar yvi ben bakar, and then afterwards, you know, as you do, you eat milk first and then you eat the meat as you do, right? V'hu ratzon olam Avraham, and that's Avraham. And Avram was standing or sitting underneath the tree talking to them the whole time, schmoozing with them so that they wouldn't be by themselves. V'yesh l'chazal sheben abakar ratz milifnei Avraham. Chazal understand that when the word ratz shows up, it's actually referring to the ben abakar itself, that it was running in front of him. And Avram was running after it, but where did the animal come from? Chazal say, V'Avram bara acher al yidei sefer yitzira. The animal ran away from Avram, and he couldn't catch it. So what did he do? He made another one. How did he make it? Using Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah is one of the most well-known Kabbalistic books that for sure existed for a very long time, precedes the Zohar. There's some dispute about who's the author. Tradition says either Adam Rishon or Avraham Avinu himself. He, according to the Midrash, Avram at least knew about the Sefer Yetzirah, and the beginning consists of a description of how God used the letters of the alphabet, or the alphabet, to create the world. And so Avram used this Sefer Yetzirah to create a calf. We thought asot oto meant that he cooked it. No, it means he made it. What's the motivation of Chazal in this case? The whole point of this is trying to explain how could Avram feed them basar v'chalav? And what's the answer?
It wasn't basar v'chalav.
It wasn't considered basar v'chalav. V'amu shehaya basar shenivra yidei sefer yetzirah she'en lo din basar. It wasn't considered meat. Wow. Because he had made it using Sefer Yetzirah, it was not considered meat, and he could therefore combine it with the milk and make a cheeseburger for them. This is what the Malbim says is the motivation of a Chazal behind this Midrash. And this is quoting in the Cheshek Shlomo.
Isn't Sefer Yetzirah is an artificial, is the same, like if you say lab grown meat is the same as in essence using Kabbalah to create a calf. It's quite a way to go from one to the other.
I tend to agree with you, and we'll have to evaluate that at the end of this section. I want to get through a few more examples of this kind of phenomenon, but I want to take up, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
But Sefer Yetzirah is the way the Kodesh Baruch Hu made the meat.
So you're saying I don't understand.
It's
a great point. It's a great point.
You can argue that's a stem cell.
It's a good point. It's a good point.
But he didn't. It wasn't a natural birth. God made the first cow. There's the chicken and the egg argument, right? What came first, the chicken or the egg?
It's a good point. I hear what you're all saying. You're saying why should it be any less legitimately meat than when God did it? It's a good point, but I don't know the answer. But the Malbim, this is how you felt it. It's a good point.
Miami, they had a burger. They say, yeah, cheese on it. I said, was it real cheese? He said, no, it was fake cheese.
That's right. That's also
fake cheese on the burger.
They do that in there's a few kosher subways, and they do that there as well.
So in your shalom, great.
Right. That's also Marasai in your shalom.
Right, except they put it on the menu, and you know, I was in Detroit once, and it was, I think it was Motzei Pesach, and my brothers-in-law went to the Dunkin' Donuts after an hour. They had to wait an hour, as they do. It's a different discussion. They went to Dunkin' Donuts, and they come in, and they came back with donuts, and one of them is eating a bacon sandwich. What's going on? I just finished Pesach, and what it is? It's a fake bacon, but that's what it's called. In the store, but everybody knows that the whole store is kosher, so it's fine. Anyways, here's another case: the shla. This is the shla kodesh. We should do this as now. You should bring in some samples next time. So this is the Shnei Luchot Habrit of Yeshaya Horowitz, one of my ancestors on my mother's side. So this is in Parashas Vayeshev. Okay, so he comments as follows on the words Vayave Yosef et dibatam ra'ah. So there's a ton of midrashic literature trying to figure out what was the lashon hara, what was the dibah ra'ah that Yosef told Yaakov about his brothers. Rashi quotes a few different things, but if you look in the midrashim, there's even more. There's a ton of it. Avi Minachai is that's the example that he gives here. She'am magid la'aviv she'ochlim Avi Minachai. So this is, I believe this is actually what Rashi quotes, that number one, they're reading Avi Minachai. Number two, they were making fun of the Bnei HaShvachot. And number three, they were involved in illicit relationships with women that they were not allowed to be with. These are some serious allegations about the Shiftei Ka. How can we believe that? And by the way, at least two of them are from the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, right? Mezalzalim Bnei Shvachot, I guess, you know, is not nice, but the other two are explicitly part of the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach. So, and if they didn't do it, then why would Yaakov believe him, and why would Yosef say such a thing? Sheker, why would he say it? So, there are actually a couple of answers to this. I'm not going to read the whole thing inside, but you can probably tell where I'm going with this. The Shla says that the Avi Minachai was not a problem. Why? Because they had made the animals with Sefer Yetzirah. And so because they had made the animals with Sefer Yetzirah, there was no problem with even the Avi Minachai. It's over here. Matzina Bagamara. The Bara Egla Tilta, if you jump down, actually, it's the Gemara that he quotes. The next source, this is explicit. Talmud Bavli Sanhedrin, open Gemara in Talmud Bavli. Rava Bara Gavra. Rava made a person. Right? He made a man. Right? This is a golem. Right? Rava Bara Gavra, Shadra Lekamid Rabbi Zeira. And then the golem went in front of Rabbi Zeira. Have a kamishtai bahadei, v'lo have a kamahadrile. And Rabbi Zeira started having a conversation with the golem. And the golem, because he was a golem, wasn't answering. Amalei min chavrayat hadalafrech. Rav Zeira got upset, said, you know, are you a person? And he said, go back to the dust, and basically he killed the golem. That's the story. The next story is Rav Chanina, Rav Ashaya, Havuyat, Vekomali Shabta, Vaski Besefer Yetzirah. Every Friday afternoon, Rabbi Chanina and Rav Ashaya would get together and they would be learning Kabbalah and they would be learning Sefer Yetzirah. Umivrulu igla tilta v'achile, and they would make a small calf, and that's what they ate on Shabbos. And they would make this every Friday afternoon. So this is the idea that they were making things. So this is in the standard Talmud Bavli, standard edition. It's not a midrash, not a Zohar, not a Malbim. This is a standard midrash. So the Shla says, and if Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Yoshaya knew how to do it, then for sure the Shvachos knew, the Shvatim knew how to do it. So that's what they did, and then it was okay to eat the Avi Minachai because it wasn't really meat at all. What? He didn't know. He looked like a normal animal. He says that. And by the way, what does he say about the women?
They were also
same thing. This is where things get really wild, okay? This is where things get really wild.
I'll try that one at home.
I had to save you a syrup. I made it myself.
Okay, so this is what he says. Look at what he says. Afshar shabrau shvatim b'tziruf otiyot misefer yitir brau nekeva v'yim b'tayli nima v'yotzev le'adam izah v'ya sover shehi nekeva isha me'ev raveim uba v'odia la'aviv shehem chashudim b'arayot. Okay? Yeah.
That's not
arayot. So it's not clear to me exactly what the arayot are. It could be just that they were hanging out with women.
Once it's made, it's real. It will carry on, right? It doesn't just disappear off. It's not like a hologram.
So this is the question over here, right? You've got two sources so far that seem to imply that even once it's made, it's not considered, you know, what it looks like. It's not what it looks like. And by the way, you know, the Gemara says here that when Rava made a person, what did Rabbi Zeira do? He killed it. If it was a person, then it would be a big deal. By the way, why is all this stuff here? So you know that this is brought l'halacha in Orach Chaim. There is, I think it's the Be'er Heitev quotes the Chacham Tzvi, who says that his father dealt with a case of, or dealt with the issue or the question, might even been a case of, with a golem, that somebody had made a golem. The question was whether it could be used for a minyan. Could it be used for a minyan? Could it be the tenth man. And the Chacham Tzvi leaves it as a tzarich iyun. He's not sure. He says leaves it as a suffix. And Rav Shachter also quotes. He says, and he's amazed. Rav Shachter is amazed. Why is he leave it as a tzarich iyun? Because there's a Gemara that says that kolam alamed as ben chavero kilu yilado. That if you teach somebody some Torah, so then it's as if they're your son. At least you give birth to them. So if you teach this golem a little bit of Torah, so it's like you've made it into a person. Shechter was like, wow, this is crazy. This is like, why would anybody leave this as a suffix? What, if you teach a cow Torah, then does it also become a person? This, you know, how can it become a human being? So what does this mean, though? So we'll get to how, you know, once I want to, when we address Avi's question, I want to take another step, by the way, past even Shechita, Rav Shechter takes it even faster. But before we get there, just a tiny little bit more.
By the way, this Shalah adds another issue to your list of issues.
Yeah.
You eat Eber Menachai from a cell created animal.
Right, so he's saying not only is it not meat in terms of basar v'chalav, it's even not meat in terms of Eber Menachai.
We discussed this in our Chabura.
We did. I'll tell you exactly why. The other answer...
The real question is, what is the status?
Yes.
Of something
of created,
man-made.
Man-made,
whatever.
But in an unnatural
sentient or life. Man-made life.
And the golem is a pretty fundamental part of that.
Yes.
You kill it, you're not higher than right.
And the Chacham Tzvi leaves that as a suffix, amazingly. And not only is he human, he's Jewish.
These are treating live animals, live people. And what we're talking about is not live.
I agree. I want to get there, but first I want to get through this. Absolutely valid point.
Absolutely an excellent point.
I just want to hold off just 1 minute before we even go further. I just want Daniel brings up another point. This is a pretty wild out answer. There is another answer which is wild, but not nearly as wild as this, and is actually really rooted in halacha. There's a concept called the ben pakua, which is very much related to this, by the way. It may help us a little bit. Ben pakua, anybody, Aaron Rabbi from the Kollel? One of the Kollel Avreichim. His father, Meir Rabbi, who's Australian.
Yeah, Australian.
So he wanted to start a ben pakua. He had a ben pakua farm for a short amount of time. Yeah. It's no longer. No. They tried to start one here in Israel. What's a ben pakua farm? So if you have a cow that's pregnant, and it's in the 8th or 9th month, and you shecht the mother cow, and then you retrieve the fetus, and the fetus lives. This fetus now is considered shechted. Now, what does that mean? It means, at the very least, at the very basis, it means that if you shecht that cow when it gets older, even if it has a trefa, and even if it's a bad shechita, then it's, according to Kol HaDeos, it's kosher l'mahadrin.
Wait, you said even if you shecht it, you don't need to shecht it.
So good. So do you technically not even need to shecht it? So midor abanan, you have to shecht it. Midor abanan is not good enough to just shoot in the head. You have to do some kind of shechita. Midor abanan, you have to shecht it.
I thought midoras you could eat it even menachai, right?
That's a question. That's a machlokus, whether or not you're allowed to eat it every menachai, and it may depend on how long it lived, and it depends on a few things. Whether or not it's Eber Menachai, that's a question. But Midrabanan, you have to shecht it.
Could that be also because of my
But what it means is that there's no issue of chalak.
Because
there is no issue of whether or not the shechita knife, you could do it however you want, anybody could do it.
You go to the status, right? If you go back to it, it's something that has to have lived. Right? So this has no halachic category of ever being alive, because it was.
You're talking about the meat.
Fetus.
Which are you talking? What are you
talking about? Both
the ben pakua
and
no, well, the, it is and, alive.
And Yosef and the stuff that's coming from Sefer Yetzirah had never been given birth to, right?
So it had no mother and father.
It had no mother and father. It was technically never alive.
Part of the issue of the ben pakua is trying to figure out what it is that makes it so mutar. And one of the arguments is that what makes it so mutar is it's not considered it's considered shechted meat. That's how we look at it. We look at it as like shechted meat. That's what
shechted the mother is part of the
because
mother.
It was part of the mother when it was shechted.
It's not shechted meat, rather than so there's no
issue of osar. That's what it is, which is why it doesn't matter whether or not it's treif or not, because the shechita from the mother
worked. It was part of the mother when the mother.
The idea behind the business is as follows: if you take two ben pakuas and you put them together, their offspring is also ben pakua. If you can create a farm of this,
then
everything is going to be kosher lemahadrin and easily shechted. It might even be pyrev. From what I heard from a mayor rabbi, went to talk to Rav Chaim Kanievsky, and Rav Chaim Kanievsky said he could feed him a cheeseburger with this meat, based on the Meshech Chachma. I wouldn't go within 10 feet of that. I would.
Yeah, but I personally that's like the creamer. Once upon a time, once everybody's.
I would never do that, but it means it brings the costs down. Now the business no longer exists, and when it was written up in Truman, you could find in Truman that they wanted to do this in the Golan. There was a farm they wanted to start, and they asked the chief rabbis. Or Bakshidon, I think, at the time, and he told them not to do it. He didn't say it was Usher. He said, but I'm allowed to tell you what I think you should do and not do, and I don't think you should do it. And he had various reasons for it. One of the sticking factors is that if a cow, a regular cow, gets in there, it ruins everything. Because the offspring of a regular cow and a ben pakua can never become kosher, and its offsprings can never become kosher. Like, it can't be shechted. Why? Because it's half shechted and half not shechted. So you can't, if you shachta, you didn't do anything, but you can't eat it yet. So that's one of the issues. That's the classic answer to what happened with Yosef. Yosef didn't know there was a ben pakua and that they were allowed to eat it, and that's one of the answers. Okay, let's just keep going. So here's the Gemara Sanhedrin that pretty much they're all relying on. We're not going to read the whole thing, but this is actually going to help us later when we talk about vegetarianism. This is a Gemara that describes the issue of eating meat in general. Rav Yehuda said in Rav's name, Adam was not permitted to eat basar. Right? Adam was not allowed to eat basar. As it is written, Baal, I have given you all the herbs. He gave him Esav and Pirot. To you it shall be for food, and to all the beasts of the earth, implying, but the beasts of the earth shall not be for you. You should not eat meat. But with the advent of the sons of Noah, who is permitted, once Noach, it's not actually Noach, it's when he gets off the Teva. That's when they were allowed to eat meat. When Noah got off the Teva, it says, every moving thing that lives shall be meat for you. That's what he told me after they got off the Teva. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. Now one might think that the prohibition of flesh cut from the living animal does not apply to them. Maybe every minachai even doesn't apply anymore. Therefore, the Torah says, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall you not eat. One might think that this prohibition applies even to reptiles. Therefore, it is stated, but how is this applied? Okay, let's jump past this. So jump to the last paragraph. The rest of it is very interesting, but the last paragraph says, a further objection is raised. Rabbi Yehuda and Pitema said, Adam reclined in the Garden of Eden while the ministering angels roasted flesh and strained wine for him. Roasted flesh? It says the Malachim were preparing a shawarma for him. What's going on? He's not allowed to eat it. Thereupon the serpent looked in, saw his glory, and became envious of him. This is continuing in the story. This is why the Nachash got jealous. The reference there is to flesh that descended from heaven. So this was flesh that just came from Shammai. But does flesh descend from heaven? Yes. As in the story of Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, who was walking on the road when lions met him and roared at him. Thereupon he quoted, the young lions roar after their prey. And two lumps of flesh descended from heaven. They ate one and left the other. Right? He distracted them with meat that came from Shammai. This he brought to the schoolhouse and propounded, is this clean fit? Then the one that was left over that the lions hadn't eaten, he brought to the Beit Midrash and said, are we allowed to eat this or not? And they answered, nothing unclean descends from heaven. Nothing tameh comes from heaven. Rav Zera asked Rav Abba, what if something is in the shape of a donkey were to descend? Meaning it's an actual non-kosher chazir, right? What if a pig falls? Pigs fall from the sky, right? Episode of The Simpsons.
When pigs fly.
Episode of The Simpsons, all right? So he replied, thou howling yarod, which is some kind of insult, I don't know. Did they not answer him that no unclean thing descends from heaven? Even if pigs fall from the sky, it's kosher. Okay? This is what they're relying on. Avi, this is the answer to your question. That, you know, there is a distinction between when something is created miraculously, we have a rule. When it comes from heaven, which apparently includes Sefer Yetzirah, it can't be not kosher. Yo, that's a good point. Everything comes from heaven. But once the world was created,
which means that the person that was created was also kosher.
Kosher.
It came from heaven.
You want to eat him.
This person that was created, right. I can
all eat people him. Might be kosher, but that's a separate issue.
Come on, there goes some IV. This is a, we're playing with weird rules all of a sudden. We get a trump card.
It happens. If it happened, it happened. We have to figure it out. By the way, this is not a nothing issue. This is not a. You know, we're obviously we're going to be talking about halacha, but this finds itself. These things are quoted in halacha in actually an everyday occurrence. There's some issue matter of debate. What bracha did the Bnei Yisrael make on Mun? So if a kid were here, I know what they would answer.
Charcoal.
They would say no. I think the kid would say it depends what it tasted like.
It wasn't like
if it tasted like ice cream, so it was shahako. If it tasted like Brussels sprouts, then it was bray pri adama. If it tasted like an apple, then it was bray pri, very, very severe. And this is one of the options. But the other option is she. What was it? It was not shahako neivetvro, but I think it was like she. Mahamotzi lechem in shamayim or something like that. Yeah. Something like that. So, or should it be shahako neivetvro? Where does this come up? It actually comes up quite often with hydroponic plants. Hydroponic plants grow from the water. They don't grow from the ground. What bracha do you make on potato that grows from the water?
I have lettuce in my house. Tell me the bracha, because I have hydroponic lettuce in my house.
Yeah?
Yes.
So this has to be discussed. It very well could be shakol. It doesn't grow from the ground, so how do you make a bracha adama? So what bracha do you make if you were to create an apple out of nothing? What bracha do you make on that? L'chore shakol? If you don't know, I mean, it doesn't come from the ground.
It's the categorization of it. It's how you view it. What defines something as needing the rules of kashrus, right?
Right.
So we define that as something that was come out of the womb of a cat.
One of the parameters. That's one of the definitions. One of the defining characteristics of an animal
is that it was
in our taxonomy is that it was born. You know, taxonomy is a funny thing. Like we consider fish to be fundamentally different from animals and animals to be fundamentally different from birds, right? Whereas science may not make those distinctions with phenotypes and families and genii and all that stuff, but we're all making it up. You know, they pick their things and we pick our things. So here too, you know, we define an animal as coming from a mother and a father, maybe.
I think it's very difficult to start saying that not giving a bracha for heights for an apple and not giving.
Why not?
Because then you put the whole Jewish world into self-ego. You know, what do you teach your kids? What to say on certain things?
So I remember hearing a story.
He goes crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember hearing a story of Chaim Soloveitchik, not the Rav's grandfather, but his son. Rav has one son, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Very brilliant and severe professor. I never learned anything from him, but he only teaches in the graduate school now. But he also used to have a shir, which apparently he's just very intense. And apparently, one time in shir, he was like, I guess he was, I think they were learning Chalchos Brachos, and he detected that the students weren't prepared. So he asked them, "What bracha do you make on a strawberry?" And the students knew that he made a bracha adama, but he asked them why, and they couldn't answer. And he sent each one after another, to the library to go look it up. Right? There was no Google. They had to look it up. And what I remember being the offshoot of the story was that on some strawberries, you make a bari pri haetz, because it depends on where it grows in the world. There are some places in the world where strawberries grow differently than they grow in other places. And so sometimes you really do have to know how something grows in order to make the bracha. And while it might be confusing, there's nothing we can do about it. The majority of strawberries you make a bari pri adama, but there may be a certain species of strawberry that you make a different bracha on. What are you going to do? You're not going to not make the right bracha on it just because we don't want to get confused. So, yeah, they have to be maybe labeled in order to know what bracha you make on it. Now, to Avi and Jake's point, what does this have to do with lab-grown meat? Now, I think the catcher is obvious. The argument might be that just like meat that is created out of nothing just doesn't come from a mother and a father, and therefore it's not natural, and therefore you don't treat it as regular meat, and you can do basar b'chalav and maybe even every minachai, and the bracha on it might be different than whatever, same bracha anyways, but all the rules that might not apply to it. So too, lab-grown meat. You take a stem cell from over here, it's not considered an animal anymore, and you stick it over there and you grow it, that's the same thing. That would be the argument, right? The question is this true? Now, once again, I would ask, you know, can we really find anybody a long time ago talking about this, or is this just 20th century? So take a look at this Meiri. This Meiri in Sanhedrin, on Daf Nun Tes, Amud Beis, that's our Gemara right here, 29b. He says, Harbe pa'amim ha'alchim ba'avir mitoch ipush ha'edim, ulisibot ha'cherot shratzim v'shar b'riot shfeilot sh'b'minei rechishot v'ashritzot v'yardot ba'aretz. So sometimes you have insects or small flying things, maggots, things like that, that are flying around. And there's no question about their isur. And just because they come down from the sky doesn't mean that they're mutar. The only time we say this is when something happens in a miraculous fashion, but not if it happens al pi teva. What are we talking about? We're only talking about cases where something happened which broke the rules of nature. That's when we have in tamei yotzei mishamayim. In davar tamei yotzei mishamayim.
I'm sure if you took Mary to the lab showing him how you're growing meat from stem cells, he'll say it's not teva.
I don't think so.
I think he'll say it's a miracle.
No, I don't think so at all. I don't think so at all. Why? First of all, Meiri is one of the rationalists. He's from the Rambam school. But I think if you explain to him what's going on, he would say fine.
There's
a famous Rashba. There's a famous Rashba where he talks about...
It's not a mofa either. You can't claim it's miraculous.
It's better than this.
There's a famous Rashba where he talks about science and magic and things that we don't understand. And he says, you know, there are all kinds of things that we don't understand in the world and nobody can ever explain them. For example, if you take this kind of metal and that kind of metal and they go together, and nobody can explain why it's happening, and sometimes they repel each other. Nobody can explain it. It looks like magic, but it's not. It's teva. They couldn't understand. They couldn't explain it. Frankly, we don't understand either. But you know, we can explain it. We can quantify it, but we don't really understand it. And so the same thing over here. We can once you control it, and nobody would ever say that this is miraculous. There's nothing miraculous about it. We know what we're doing, and we know how things work, and we do it. Baruch Hashem gave us the ability to do it, but you know, we're not breaking any rules. So according to this Meiri, I would argue that it's the same. Who agrees? Rabbi Bleich. For the rest of what we're talking about, we're going to be relying heavily on Rabbi J. David Bleich, one of the major, major contemporary halachic authorities, writers in America. I've edited a few of his articles for Tradition. This one I didn't edit. Yeah, he's still alive. He teaches in law school. He knows everything. He teaches in everything.
Where is he? Where does he live?
America.
In New York?
Yeah. He's a Rosh, I don't know if he's a Rosh Hashiva in YU. He works in YU. And he writes very often Tradition. He's written a few books. I think we have one over here, Contemporary Halacha. He wrote a whole series. So every year he puts out, you know, articles about new issues. So this was actually from 2013. Okay? So this is already 6 years ago. But it's the year that the burger was eaten. This is the motivation for the article was the $325,000 burger. So he says, assuredly, foodstuffs produced synthetically rather than miraculously, synthetically here he does mean lab-grown meat, are similarly permissible despite their non-kosher characteristics and appearance. Since, however, the widely publicized stem cell burger was... Oh, sorry. No, he doesn't mean that. Synthetically, he means plant-based. Since, however, the widely publicized stem cell burger was neither miraculously nor synthetically produced, the above-cited discussions do not cast light on the present-day quandary. According to Bleich, the whole conversation we just had is not germane to the topic at all. Not an issue. We're not talking about miraculous creation of meat. We're talking about scientific creation of meat. And therefore, none of those, you know, not all the rules apply. All the rules still apply, at least from this perspective. It needs to pass the rules of kosher. Who disagrees? Rav Schechter. Rav Herschel Schechter. Another Rav Herschel Schechter, same school, right? And he, I've seen it written, and today I listened to a shiur where he said it, and I'll tell you to what extent he said it. I was amazed. So this is from an article, though, that from somebody who had a conversation with him. It says, "B'zicha imo b'kaf beit ba'adar tafshinayim bet, hivhir harav Schechter." So that's 7 years ago. So this is a year before that burger. "Hivhir harav Schechter sheledato basar hu rak davar shemekaro mibal chayim shenolad me'em b'derech hateva." Meat is defined as coming from a mother. Kol basar shemutzar b'derech acheret, eino basar l'inanim hilchatiim. Meat that comes from any other source.
What's his reasoning based on?
He says it has to come from a mother and a father. That's the definition of life.
It was never alive.
Never alive. He says that this is why we're not worried about the golem. This is why we don't worry about whether he's Jewish or not, or whether you can kill him. Now, what does this mean?
He's basically saying this stem cell stuff is parv.
Yeah, absolutely. He said 100% the stem cell stuff should be parv. So it should be parv, kosher, it's not even meat, it's nothing.
The life that it comes from.
Yes.
The stem cell was alive.
Yes, it was, but then it became a stem cell. We'll see a little bit clearer why he thinks that the stem cell is no longer considered meat, that it goes through a process of not being meat anymore. And then it's easy for him to say that, okay, once it goes through a process of not being meat anymore, when it becomes meat again, right, which is what happens, becomes meat again, it's not considered meat, right? So maybe that's important, but his point is that it's not born to a mother and a father. I heard him say today.
And this is any meat.
Any meat, it would seem. It would seem. Yes. And that for other reasons that we'll see later. It gets wilder, okay, and maybe we'll finish on this point. I heard him say, his voice, I assume that he's going to have to get back to this if ever it becomes relevant. I have no doubt he's going to have to get back to this. The same applies to humans. A human is somebody who's born to a mother and a father. What does that mean? It means, and actually he said even further, it's born in the womb of a mother. And so he said that if you do in vitro fertilization, if you do in vitro fertilization, which means, you know, that it's inserted into the mother, or
the fertilization happens
as long as it's as long as the fetus grows in the mother's stomach, then it's human. But if it's not grown in the mother's stomach, it's not human al pi halacha.
Grown in the mother's stomach means it's fertile. The difference between grown and fertilized in the mother. There's a difference.
I'm nearly 100% certain that he said grown.
All right, that still allows for in vitro fertilization.
Yes. 100%, yes. Oh, okay. Yes. But what does it mean? It means
take the meat argument even further on that. He's saying as long as the nutrients coming outside.
Forget the meat. He means that if you take sperm and an egg, and no doubt this will happen, and grow it in an incubator, that child, he would consider not human.
What would he consider it? Like?
Not human.
Wouldn't have to keep
that's it.
But it has to have some status.
That's it. It's not Jewish. Look, taking to the extreme, there's no Isser v'tzicha. That's what that would mean. That's why I say, I assume he will revisit this when it becomes relevant. He may maintain that still. He may say the same thing. But he said it. I heard it. So, and that, you know, that was an offshoot of this conversation, which is how he explains the Gemara. This is Rav Bar Gavra. If we assume that Rav Bar Gavra doesn't just mean like a golem, like, you know, automaton, but really he created a human, then how could Rav Zera kill it? And the answer is because it wasn't human.
It did cloning of a sheep, like.
Dali.
Yeah.
Dali.
Like 7 or 8 years ago.
Dali, yeah.
Yeah.
30 years. Yeah, more than that. No, I remember it. I remember Dali.
25, 30 years ago.
Cloning was still grown inside of wood.
Yeah, that might be right. I don't remember.
By the way, if the...
Actually, just one second. I'll tell you one thing. I was actually... It's funny. I was sitting today at lunch. It was just so ironic that... it's actually not surprising. I was sitting today at lunch with one of my Arab colleagues. And I was asking him questions about kashrus in Islam. And he was asking me questions. And I was telling what I was talking about tonight. And he said, you know, I read an article just recently that they grew a human fetus to 3 months in a pig. And my only question was, why? I was just like, what's the use case? Why would they do that? He said, and after 3 months, they decided they killed it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because they said it wasn't humane. That was their issue. I don't know. Yes, that's why they did it in a pig, but why would they do it at all? I don't understand. I didn't understand that.
There's meant to be a moratorium against any human testing beyond like a matter of like week or 2 weeks.
So he said 3 months, but he was just remembering.
There's also rogue doctors or especially.
So, you know, we're going to stop there for tonight because it's 11:15, but there's, you know, obviously a lot more to discuss. As you know, just to recap that last part, according to Rav Bleich, and I think according to, I would guess, well, I mean, the rest of the conversations are not relevant unless we agree with Rav Bleich. According to the majority of the post-gim, I think, we cannot glean from the discussions about miraculous creation of meat and learn from that to lab-grown meat, because it's completely natural, lab-grown meat. And it doesn't lose its status of meat, at least to that degree. According to Rav Schachter, we're done. Once it's a stem cell, it's not even meat anymore.
But he's not relying on those sources. He's not saying it's...
He is. He's saying the halacha has decided...
He's saying once it's no longer meat, it's a stem cell and it's new. But he's not saying it's miraculous. He's not relying...
He's saying it has the same status as miraculous meat.
It has this,
he says miraculous meat is a category of non-natural meat, and so is this.
There's enough Gemara. One is to say it has the same status as miraculous meat, and the other is to say it just doesn't have the status of meat.
What's the nafkamina?
Well, I don't know, but
okay.
But it's not the same thing.
I understand the point that you're making. Maybe the bracha would be different.
That's what you're looking for.
Say, says that on this when you talk about kosher, about don't the mother in his mother's milk, don't bathe the kid in his mother's milk.
Right.
Then you understand the importance of a mother and a father for all the rules of the meat. And that's we didn't really get to that being the thread of basar, or that's what we got to in the end. Did we see that elsewhere other than in the Torah? And they define what kosher is, then we do all this exploratory discussion about that is
the idea of mothers and children.
That is the anchor of kosher.
There are other mitzvot, there's about tovet beno, that you can't shecht a mother and its child at the same time. But I think what you're trying to figure out is do we have any indication in the Torah that kashrut of an animal or animal status relies on it coming from a mother? It would be hard to evaluate, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think you have a good point. There could be all kinds of reasons for that. It's an interesting question.
It's the humane aspect. I mean, if you start looking at Tame of shechting and everything else, the idea of it goes into the veganism argument as well, to say that the whole argument that the fact we're allowed to eat meat is b'dievet, and it's to give in to our natural tithes of wanting to destroy something, that actually, once you take out that whole killing something from the process, it changes the whole way you do it.
We'll have to get back to it, yeah. I mean, there is look, without jumping the gun, you know, you could make another argument, though, that it's not the killing aspect of the meat, but it's the eating of the meat. And not the fact that it was a living creature, but that there might be something in the meat. I don't know if this is a Kabbalistic argument or it's just...
Love.
Yes, that's true, but also... I wouldn't make necessarily a scientific argument, but some kind of spiritual argument that eating meat, the Ramban says this explicitly, somehow transfers that animalisticness into you, and then maybe the lab-grown meat won't be any different. I'll be the Ramban. He writes that explicitly. And then maybe it depends on what kind of animal you take it from, right? Maybe a cow would be okay, but there's a reason why a lion wouldn't be okay, and then maybe even lion meat. I'll be that, but that may be already far afield. Well, that's one of the things we're going to discuss. All right.
Wait, here's
my
team.